and unload all of this. I pull up my favorites list, then stop with my finger over Elliot's number. After what he said about Grandma Judy yesterday, it seems almost disloyal to tell him how much she's slipping. I don't realize until my phone rings and I see the name on the screen that there is someone I can talk to. I think of the expression on his face when he spoke of those difficult last promises to his grandfather, the promises that kept May Crandall's secrets and my grandmother's, and instinctively, I know he'll understand. Something in me rushes headlong across the distance, even though we haven't spoken since that day at the nursing home several weeks ago. I told myself I wouldn't get in touch with him again, that it was better to leave things be and move on. As soon as I answer, he seems unsure of why he's called. I wonder if he's been thinking the same thing I have. There's no place for a friendship between the two of us. Our parking lot encounter with Leslie proved that point. He says finally,
I've seen some of the press about the nursing home expose. You've been on my mind.
A warm, pleasant sensation rushes through me. I'm completely unprepared for it. I will it not to show in my voice. Oh, don't remind me. If this keeps up much longer, I'm liable to go all Ninja Turtle on someone.
No, you aren't.
You're right, I guess. But I'd like to. It's so incredibly frustrating. I understand that my father is in public office, but we're still human, you know? You'd think some topics would be off the table, like cancer for one, and watching your grandmother struggle to remember anything about who she is for another. It feels like people will poke a spear in any place they can draw blood these days. It wasn't that way when I was growing up. Even in politics, people had some... I search for the word, and the best thing I can come up with is... decency.
We live in an entertainment-driven world, Trent says soberly. Everything's fair game.
I open my mouth to further vent about the attacks on my family, and then think better of it. Sorry, I didn't mean to unload on you. Maybe I need another trip to the beach. It's not until the words are out that I realize how flirty they sound.
How about lunch instead?
What?
I just thought I'd see if you were free, since I'm in Aiken. I've been doing a little digging around in my granddad's papers and talking to people who helped him with his searches. One of them is a man who was a courthouse worker in Shelby County, Tennessee, back when all the adoption records were still sealed. From what I can tell, he funneled quite a bit of information to Granddad.
Instantly, I'm back in the thick of it. The scents of that tiny Edisto cabin tease my senses. I smell pipe tobacco, old newspaper clippings, dried-out bulletin boards, peeling paint, faded photos. You mean so that your grandfather could help adoptees find their relatives, right? So, you're taking up where he left off, then?
Not really. I was nosing around for May Crandall, thinking maybe I'd uncover something about the little brother she never found, Gabian.
I'm momentarily stunned. This guy is genuine to the core. He's also a better person than I am. I've been so obsessed with family problems. I've been delaying calling the seniors' rights pack about May's situation. Now I realize that I've been brushing this task aside on purpose. I'm afraid to have anything to do with her, given all the controversy after the Aging Unevenly article. If word got out that I was helping her, our political enemies would accuse me of using her to prop up our bruised public image. I can't be seen having lunch with Trent, either. I can't possibly go, but I can't quite make myself say no, so I continue the sidetrack. That's really nice of you. What did you find?
Nothing significant so far. There was an address in California in the court paperwork. I wrote to it just to see if they might know anything about a 2-year-old boy adopted from the Tennessee Children's Home Society in 1939, or possibly even just who lived at that address in the late 30s. It's a long shot, though.
So you drove here to tell May that?
Nah, I don't want to get her hopes up unless something comes of it. I actually came here for Jelly. When I left you last time, I went by to visit my aunt outside Aiken. She was putting up blackberry preserves. They're ready now.
A little laugh puffs out of me. 2.5 hours is a long way to drive for Jelly.
You've never tasted my aunt's blackberry preserves. Besides, Jonah loves to go there. Uncle Bobby still has a mule.
So Jonah's with you? Lunch suddenly seems a possibility if it'll be the three of us. Even if we were seen, no one would think twice about it with Jonah there. I rush through my mental queue of the afternoon's plans, trying to calculate whether I can rearrange a few things and sneak away long enough. You know what? I'd love to have lunch with you two.
I think I can tear Jonah away from Uncle Bobby and the mule. Tell me when and where. Any particular place you'd like to go? We're pretty flexible, as long as it's not during nap time. That can get ugly.
Again, his comment makes me chuckle. When's nap time?
Around 2.
All right, then. How does an early lunch sound? Maybe about 11? Is that too soon? I don't have any idea how far out of town his aunt's house is, but if there's a mule involved, it isn't close to where I am right now. No one has farmed around Magnolia Manor for years. The estates here are pristine. You pick the place, and I'll meet you there. Nothing too upscale, though, all right? Something kind of out of the way would be good.
Trent laughs. We don't do upscale. We're actually into eateries with playscapes. Know one of those by chance?
My mind skips back in time and lands on a nice memory. Actually, I do. There's an old drive-in with a little playground not far from my grandmother's house. She used to take us there when we were kids. I give him directions, and we're set. Best of all, if we meet at 11, no one will even miss me at home. I am an adult, I rationalize, navigating a U-turn and starting toward Grandma Judy's neighborhood. I shouldn't have to feel like a teenager sneaking out just because I make lunch plans with a friend. I do have a right to some sort of life of my own, don't I? I lose myself in my mental debate for a while, my thoughts turning corners along with the car. Maybe I've gotten spoiled up in Maryland, living in my own little anonymous world, working a job that was mine and only mine, not tied to a support staff, to offices in D.C. and the home state, to constituents, contributors, and an entire political network. Maybe I never realized how much being a Stafford is an all-consuming thing, especially here in our native territory. The collective identity is so overwhelming. There's no room for an individual one. Once upon a time, I liked that. Didn't I? I enjoyed the perks that came with it. Every path I stepped on was instantly smoothed down before me. But now, I've had a taste of climbing my own mountains my own way. Have I grown beyond this life? The idea splits me down the middle, leaving half of my identity on each side of the divide. Am I my father's daughter? Or am I just me? Do I have to sacrifice one to be the other?
Surely this is only a reaction to all of the stress lately.
Pausing at a stop sign, I looked down Grandma Judy's street, past the dip in the road where we kids splashed in puddles when it rained, past the neatly trimmed hedge and the mailbox with the iron horse head atop.
There's a taxi sitting in my grandmother's driveway. In a town the size of Aiken, it's not a typical sight. I hesitate at the intersection and watch the cab a moment. It doesn't back away and leave. Maybe the driver is unaware that nobody lives there anymore? He must be waiting in front of the wrong house. Turning down her street, I fully expect him to be leaving when I pull in, but he's not. In fact, he seems to be dozing in the driver's seat. He doesn't move when I drive past him and get out of my car. He looks young, almost like a teenager, but he must be old enough to have a commercial driver's license. There's no passenger in the back seat, and no one around the house as far as I can see. I'd suspect that this was related to some sort of hideous news exposé, a reporter skulking around snapping photos to show how the other half lives. But why would someone like that travel by cab? The driver jumps about a foot when I knock on the half-open window. His mouth hangs open as he tries to blink me into focus.
"Ugh, guess I fell asleep," he apologizes. "Sorry, ma'am."
"I think you're in the wrong place," I tell him. He glances around, stifles a yawn, flutters his thick, dark lashes against the bright late-morning sunlight.
"No. No, ma'am. The reservation's for 10:30.
I check my watch. "You've been here for almost a half hour, sitting in the driveway?" Who would have directed a cab to my grandmother's house?
"You must have the wrong address.
Some poor customer is probably pacing the floors about now." The driver doesn't seem worried in the least. Straightening in his seat, he glances at the console.
"No, ma'am. It's a standing reservation. Every Thursday at 10:30. Prepaid, so my boss says come here and sit, since it's already paid for."
Every Thursday? I cycle through the schedule, what I can remember of it, from the time when Grandma Judy was still living here with a full-time caretaker. The day she ended up lost and confused at a shopping mall, she was in a cab.
"How long have you been doing this? Coming here every Thursday?"
Maybe I should call the office so you can talk."
"No, it's okay." I'm afraid the office won't answer my questions. The kid behind the wheel doesn't seem to know any better.
"When you picked my grandmother up on Thursdays, where did you take her?"
"Over by Augusta. A place on the water there. I only drove her a few times, but my dad and my grandpa did for maybe a couple years. We're a family company. 4 generations.
The last part sounds sweetly as if he plucked it straight from the billboard. "Years?" I'm so confused, the word doesn't even begin to describe me right now. There was nothing in my grandmother's daybooks about a standing Thursday appointment. She had no standing appointments, other than bridge circles and beauty shop visits. And Augusta? That's 30 minutes or so each way. Who in the world would she have been visiting regularly in the Augusta area? And in a cab? And for years?
"And she went to the same place every time?" I ask.
"Yes, ma'am. As far as I know."
He looks extremely uncomfortable now. On the one hand, he realizes I'm grilling him. On the other hand, he doesn't want to lose what has obviously been a long-standing fare. I can't imagine what the price for the trip to Augusta might be.
My hand settles over the top of his window. It might be silly, but I want to make sure he doesn't try to flee the scene while I sort out the barrage of information. A place on the water there. Something completely unexpected pops into my mind. A place on the water. You mean on the river? The Savannah River runs through Augusta. When Trent and I talked to May, she mentioned Augusta. Something about going home and drifting down the Savannah River.
Well, yeah, the place could be on the river. The gate's all kind of overgrown-like. I just drop her off there and wait. I don't know what happens after she goes in.
How long did she usually stay?
A few hours. Pop used to walk down to the bridge and fish while he waited. She didn't care. She'd come out and honk on the cab horn when she was ready to go.
I just stand there gaping at him. I can't even begin to reconcile all of this with the grandmother I knew. The grandmother I thought I knew. Was she writing May Crandall's story after all? Or is there more? Can you take me there? I blurt out. The cabbie shrugs. He moves to exit the car so he can open the back door for me.
Sure, yeah. The fare's paid for.
My pulse inches upward. Goosebumps dot my arms. If I get in this car, where will I end up? My phone buzzes, reminding me that I was headed someplace before this detour. It's a text from Trent telling me he and Jonah are holding down a table for us. The hamburger stand is already crowded this morning. Instead of texting back, I slip away from the cabbie and call Trent. I apologize for not being there and ask, could you come with me to do something? The explanation of where I am and what's happening sounds even more bizarre when I voice it out loud. Fortunately, Trent doesn't decide that I've lost it. Actually, he's intrigued. We make plans for the cab to swing by the restaurant so Trent and Jonah can follow in their car.
Meantime, I'll grab a burger to go for you, Trent offers. World-famous shakes here. Jonah's giving it the thumbs up already. Want one?
Thanks. That sounds good. But I'm not sure I could eat a thing at the moment. On the short ride to the restaurant, I can hardly stay focused. I'm so on edge. Trent is waiting in the parking lot with Jonah already buckled in. He hands me a sack and a shake and tells me he'll be right behind me.
You okay? He asks.
Our gazes catch for a moment, and I'm lost in the deep blue of his eyes. I find myself relaxing into them, thinking, Trent's here. It'll be all right. The thought almost lifts the mass of dread that's growing inside me. Almost. Unfortunately, I understand the feeling well enough to know I shouldn't ignore it. It's the sixth sense that always comes alive when I'm about to learn something practically unthinkable about the players in a case I'm working on. The trusted neighbor was responsible for the child's disappearance. The innocent-looking eighth grader was stocking up on pipe bombs. The clean-cut father of four had a computer full of disgusting pictures. That sense is preparing me for something. I just don't know what. I'm fine, I say. I'm just afraid of where this cab is going to end up, and what we might find. Trent lays a hand on my arm, and my skin seems to heat up under his fingers.
You want to ride with us? We can just follow the cab.
He glances toward his car, where Jonah is waving madly from his booster seat, trying to get my attention. He'd like to share his fries with me. No, but thanks. I need to talk to the driver some more on the way. Really? I think he's told me all he knows, but I want to keep the young man busy so he doesn't check in with the office. His father may have a different opinion of my using Grandma Judy's fare to transport me to a mystery location. He may be savvy enough to realize this could bring up a privacy issue. And I don't want to take any chances on his getting away from us. Trent's fingers trail down my arm as he lets go. Or maybe that's just my imagination.
We'll be right behind you, okay?
I nod and wave at Jonah, who gives me a fries and teeth grin. And then we're off. The midday traffic is light on the 35-minute trip, so it's easy for the driver to chat. He tells me his name is Oz, and that when he drove my grandmother, she always gave him cookies, or chocolates, or sweets left over from parties and gatherings. Because of that, he remembers her well. He's sorry to hear she's in a care facility now. Clearly, he's oblivious to all the newspaper coverage and controversy. He's been busy working after having taken over much of the driving for his father, who's having some health problems.
I was worried about her the last time I brought her here,
he admits as we leave the highway and wind through rural roads, presumably drawing near our destination. Walls of lowland shrubs, climbing vines, and tall pine trees tighten around us, pressing inward as we turn, then turn again.
She was getting around okay, but she seemed kind of confused. I asked her if I could walk her in the gate, but she wouldn't let me. She said there'd be a golf cart waiting for her on the other side, like always, and not to worry. So I let her off. That was the last time I drove her.
I sit silently in the back seat, attempting to conjure the images as Oz talks. I try, but I just can't fathom the things he's describing.
The week after that was my dad's heart surgery. We had a substitute driver filling in for a month or so. Next time I drove on a Thursday, I came to the house, and there was nobody there. Been that way ever since. The substitute driver didn't have any idea what happened. Last he saw of her, he let her off at a shopping mall, and she said she'd see him again the next Thursday. We've tried calling the number on her bill, but nobody answers, and nobody's there when I show up. We wondered if something might have happened to her. Sorry if we caused a problem.
It's not your fault. Her caretaker shouldn't have been letting her leave alone in the first place. Good help is hard to find these days, but my grandmother was also surprisingly adept at convincing her helpers that she was perfectly competent and we were being overly controlling. Obviously, they were allowing her to take off in a cab on Thursdays. Then again, she was the one writing their paychecks, and they weren't unaware of that fact. She wasn't above dismissing household help that gave her trouble. The car bumps over an old WPA bridge with crumbling cement railings and moss-covered arches. The driver slows, but I don't see any sign of houses or mailboxes. From all appearances, we're out in the middle of nowhere. Good thing Oz knows exactly where he's going. Anyone who didn't would have missed the turn completely. The barely visible remnant of a gravel driveway sketches two scraggly paths through the roadside grass and across a drainage culvert. Just beyond, a massive stone entranceway lies hidden among trumpet vines and blackberry brambles. Heavy iron gates, each perhaps 8 feet in height, hang askew, their weight supported by leaves and runners, the hinges long since rusted away. A decaying chain and padlock seem almost like somebody's idea of a joke. No one has driven through these gates in decades. Just beyond them, there's a sycamore tree 6 inches across, its muscular arms reaching through the bars and slowly lifting one gate higher than the other.
There's the way in.
Oz points out a narrow path leading to a walk-through entrance beside the main one. It's obviously functional. The trail beneath it padded down enough that the summer grass hasn't completely taken over.
That's where she always went.
Behind us, a car door slams. I jump and glance back before remembering it's Trent. When I turn around again, I'm struck by a strong feeling that the gateway should be gone. Poof. I'll wake up in my bed at Drayden Hill thinking, now that was a strange dream. But the gate hasn't vanished, and the path is still waiting.
Chapter 22. Rill. Fern freezes halfway across the sitting room. Her body goes stiff so that I can see every little string of muscle. A second later, she's wetting herself for the first time in weeks. Fern! I snap under my breath, because I don't want Mrs. Sevier to hear me and come see what Fern's just done. Our new mommy's so proud of Fern that she takes us to the movies and talks about trips we'll go on together and how we'll see Santa at Christmas and what he'll bring for us. She's even got it in her head that we should all drive to Augusta to visit her mama. I don't want to go to Augusta, but I also don't want any trouble now that Mrs. Sevier has started letting us out of her sight a little more. I hurry across the room and strip off Fern's dress and shoes and socks, use them to sop up the puddle. Go on upstairs before she sees. I can hear Mrs. Sevier talking to someone in the front parlor. Fern's mouth quivers, and her eyes fill up with tears. She just stands there while I roll up the wet clothes and stuff them behind the ash bin where I can take care of them later. All of a sudden, I know why Fern's not moving. There's another voice in the parlor. The closer I get, the more it sends ice slivers through me, right down to the bone. Go hide under your bed, I whisper against Fern's ear, and push her toward the stairs. Fern runs up to the second floor and disappears. Breath comes in and out of my nose in short gasps as I flatten myself against the stairway wall and creep closer to the open parlor door. In the kitchen, Zuma turns on the electric mixer. I can't hear the voices for a minute, but then I do.
A very unfortunate situation, but it does happen, Miss Tan is saying. It's never my wish to take the children away once we've found good homes for them.
But my husband, the papers, we were promised that the girls would be ours to keep. Mrs. Sevier's voice wavers and cracks. A teacup rattles against a saucer. It seems like forever before Miss Tan answers.
As well they should be.
She sounds like she feels sorry for our troubles.
But adoptions are not final for 1 year. Birth families can be so difficult. The grandmother of these children has petitioned to gain custody of them.
I gasp, then hear the soft sound of it, and slap a hand over my mouth. We don't even have a grandmother. Not that I know of, anyhow. Briny's folks are dead, and Queenie hasn't seen her people since she ran off with Briny.
This can't...
Mrs. Sevier lets out a sob that sounds like it'll break her in two. She sniffles and coughs, and finally forces out some words.
We can't let this... Darren will be home for lunch. Please, please wait. He'll know what to do.
Oh my, I'm afraid I've upset you more than is necessary.
Miss Tan sounds sticky sweet, but I can picture her face. She's smiling the same mean smile she had when Mrs. Polnick was holding me down on my knees. Miss Tan likes the way people look when they're afraid.
I wasn't planning to take the children with me today. You can fight this foolishness, of course. You should, in fact. The grandmother has no real means of providing for the girls. They would have a terrible life. May and little Beth are depending on you to protect them. But you must realize that
legal work can be costly. Costly? For people of your obvious means, that shouldn't be a difficulty, now should it? Not when the fate of 2 innocent children is at stake. 2 children whom you've come to dearly love. Yes, but $3,000, perhaps a bit more, that should go quite a distance toward resolving these legal issues. 3,000? Perhaps 4. What are you saying? Another pause and then, nothing matters more than your family. Don't you agree? I can hear that horrible smile in Miss Tan's voice. I want to run in there and tell the truth. I want to point at her and yell, liar! We don't even have a grandma. And I had 3 sisters, not 2, and a baby brother, and his name was Gaby and not Robbie. And you took him away, just like you took my sisters. I want to tell all of it. I can taste the words on my tongue. But I can't say them. If I do, I know what'll happen. Miss Tan will take us back to the children's home. She'll give Fern to someone else, and we won't be together anymore. Mrs. Sevier sniffles and coughs again. Of course, I agree, but... She breaks down and sobs again, apologizing for it all the while. A chair creaks and groans, and heavy, uneven footsteps cross the floor. Talk with your husband. Express your sincere feelings on the matter. Tell him how much you need the children, and how much they need you. I won't bother with seeing the girls today. I'm sure they're doing quite well under your care. Thriving, even. Her footsteps move closer to the doors at the other end of the room. I push off the wall and run up the stairs. The last thing I hear is Miss Tan's voice echoing through the house. No need getting up. I can show myself out. I'll expect to be hearing from you by tomorrow. Time is of the essence. Upstairs, I hurry to Fern's room. I don't even get her out from under the bed. I just slip under there with her. We lay face to face the way we always did on the Arcadia. It's all right, I whisper. I won't let her take us back. I promise. No matter what. I hear Mrs. Sevier pass by in the hallway. Her sobbing echoes off the wood walls and the high ceiling with the gold edges. The door closes at the end of the hall, and I hear her take to her bed and cry and cry and cry, just like she used to when I first came here. Zuma comes up and knocks on the door, but it's locked, and Mrs. Sevier won't let anyone in. She's still in the bed when Mr. Sevier comes home for lunch. By then, I've got Fern cleaned up, and I've read her a book, and she's sound asleep with her thumb in her mouth, and the teddy bear she calls Gabby, like it's our baby brother. I listen while Mr. Sevier unlocks their bedroom. After he goes inside, I tiptoe out where I can listen better. I don't even need to be very close to hear how mad Mr. Sevier is after his missus tells him what happened. This is blackmail, he shouts. It's nothing but outright blackmail. We can't let her take the girls, Darren, Mrs. Sevier pleads. We can't. I will not be blackmailed by this woman. We paid the adoption fees, which, by the way, were exorbitant, particularly the second time around. Darren, please. Victoria, if we let this get started, there will be no stopping it. Something metal topples over and clatters across the floor. Where does it end, then? Tell me that.
I don't know, but we have to do something.
Oh, I'll do something, all right. That woman doesn't know who she's dealing with.
The door handle rattles, and I hurry to my room.
Darren, please, please listen to me.
Mrs. Sevier begs.
We'll go to Mama's home in Augusta. Belgrove has more than enough space, and the place is too much for her now that Daddy is gone.
The girls will have aunts and uncles and all of my friends there. We'll take Hoy and Zuma and Hootsie. We can stay as long as need be. Permanently, even. Mama is lonely, and Belgrove House needs a family. It's a wonderful place to grow up. Now, Victoria, this is our home. I've finally gotten my little studio building underway down by the lake. The McCameys aren't the fastest workers, but they have the piers and the flooring in place, and they're making progress on framing up the walls. We can't let Georgia Tan put us out of our home. My family home, for heaven's sake.
Belgrove has acres and acres along the Savannah River. You can build another studio, a bigger one.
Any kind you want.
Mrs. Sevier talks so fast, I can hardly make out the words.
Please, Taryn, I can't live here knowing that woman could come knocking on our door at any moment to take our children.
Mr. Sevier doesn't answer. I close my eyes and dig my fingernails into my fuzzy pink wallpaper. Waiting. Hoping.
Let's not do anything rash, Mr. Sevier says finally. I have a meeting to go to in the city tonight. I'll pay a visit to Miss Tan and settle this matter face to face once and for all. We'll see how bold she is in her demands then.
Mrs. Sevier doesn't argue anymore. I hear her crying softly, and the bed creaking, and him comforting her.
Come now, darling. No more tears. It'll be taken care of. And if you'd like to take the girls to visit in Augusta, we can arrange that as well.
I stand there with my mind rushing through 100 thoughts. And then it stops and settles on one. I know what I have to do. There's no more time to waste. I hurry to my dresser to get what I need and then run downstairs. In the kitchen, Zuma has lunch ready, but she's over in the corner with her head in the laundry chute, so she can listen to what's happening with the Sevieres. Hootsie's probably halfway up the chute telling everything she hears. On the chopping block, there's a little picnic basket ready to go down to the McCamey's construction camp. Normally, Zuma would make Hootsie take it down there. Hootsie hates that, and so does Zuma. Zuma says the McCameys are nothing but white trash, and they'll steal Mr. Sevier blind if he turns his back. The only good thing is Zuma and Hootsie hate us less now, because they're busy hating the McCamey boys and their daddy. I grab the basket and run out the door yelling,
I'll take this to the camp. I've got a movie handbill to give to the boy down there anyhow.
I'm gone before Zuma can argue that I'll be late for lunch. I bolt out the back, jump off the veranda, and cross the yard as fast as my legs will take me, all the while looking over my shoulder to see if Hootsie's following me. It's a relief that she doesn't. Down by the lake, Mr. McCamey is more than ready to settle under a shade tree when I show up with the basket. Near as I can figure, he's always willing to stop working. The only reason he's got his sweat worked up today is because his two biggest boys went to the neighbor's place to help cut a lightning-felled tree off their barn and fix the roof. They won't be back for a day or two, until that job's done. The only help Mr. McCamey's got right now is the youngest boy. Arnie is his name, but Mr. McCamey just calls him Boy. I nod at Arnie, and he follows me up the path to a willow tree where we've sat and talked before. I slip under the branches and give Arnie a sandwich, an apple, and two sugar cookies I squirreled away in my pocket. Arnie's a scrawny little thing, so usually when I come down here, I bring him food he doesn't have to share with the rest of the McCameys. I figure he needs it. He's a year older than me, but not even as tall as I am yet.
Brought you something else today.
I give him the handbill from the movie theater. He holds the picture of a cowboy on a tall yellow horse and whistles long and low.
It sure is pretty. Tell me how the tale went. Was there lots of shooting?
He sits down, and I sit down with him. I want to share all about the movie Mrs. Sevier took us to, and the theater with its big red velvet seats and tall towers that looked like they should have been on a king's castle. But there isn't time to talk about those things. Not today. Not with what's happened. I have to get Arnie to say yes to what I asked him yesterday. The moon will be full tonight. And on the water, it'll be almost bright as high noon. With Arnie's brothers gone, there won't be a better time. I can't let Mrs. Sevier drag us off to Augusta. I can't let Miss Tan make us go back to the home. And besides that, Fern's starting to think of Mrs. Sevier as her mama. Little by little, her mind's letting loose of our real mama. At bedtime, I sneak over to Fern's room and tell her about Queenie and Briny. But it's not working anymore. Fern's forgetting the river and Kingdom Arcadia. She's forgetting who we are. It's time for us to go. So, what we talked about yesterday. You're gonna take us, right? I ask Arnie. Tonight, the moon will be up early and long. You don't live all your life on the river without knowing how the moon travels. The river and its critters choose their moods according to the moon. Arnie jerks away like I've slapped him. He pinches his brown eyes closed. A shock of thin, reddish-brown hair falls across his forehead and parts over his long, bony nose. He shakes his head in a nervous way. Maybe he never meant to help us at all. Maybe it was just big talk when he said he could run his daddy's boat, and he knows how to get through the Oxbow Lake and Dead Man's Slough all the way to the big river. But I told him the truth about Fern and me. The whole story. I even gave him our real names. I thought he understood why we needed his help. He rests his elbows on his dirty overalls where his knees poke through. I'd sure enough miss you if you's gone. Y'all been the only thing good about this place so far. You can come with us. Old Zeed's fetched up lots of boys. He'd take you on, I bet. I'm sure he would. You'd never have to see this place again. You could be free. Just like we're gonna be. Arnie's daddy drinks every night and works his boys like sawmill mules and beats on them all the time, especially Arnie. Hootsie saw Arnie get whooped upside the head with a hammer handle just for bringing his daddy the wrong peck of nails. And either way, the pearls are yours, just like I promised. I dig in my pocket and pull them out and hold them in my hand where Arnie can see. I feel bad about the pearls. Mrs. Sevier gave them to me the night after she took Fern to get fitted for the special shoes. She thought it was my birthday, on account of that's what the papers from the Tennessee Children's Home Society said. The Seviers figured I'd forgot all about it being my special day, and they surprised me with a party at supper. I was surprised, all right. My birthday was 5.5 months ago, and I'm already a whole year older than they think I am. But my name isn't May Weathers either, so a birthday in the fall didn't matter too much to me. The pearls are the prettiest things that have ever been mine, but I'd give them up for Queenie and Briny and the river. I'd hand them over quick as a wink. Besides, Arnie needs the price they'll fetch more than I do. Half the time, they've got whiskey but no food in their camp. Arnie touches the pearls, then pulls his hand away and picks at a scab on his knuckle. I couldn't leave my family, my brothers and such. Think on it real hard. About staying on the river with us, I mean. Truth is that Arnie's brothers are practically grown, and they're just about as bad as Arnie's daddy. Once they get tired of working like dogs and finally decide to light off, Arnie's likely to starve to death or get beaten till he breaks right in two. Briny and Queenie can find you a place, I promise. They'll be so happy you brought Fern and me back, they'll find you a really good place. If Zeed's not there at Mud Island anymore, you can stay with us on the Arcadia till we come across Zeed again. A little worry sliver pokes under my skin. Really, I haven't got any way of being sure Briny and Queenie are still tied up in our same spot. Except that I just know. They'd wait there forever if they had to. Even though the nights are getting cooler, and the leaves are falling, and it's time to be headed south down the river to warmer country. What I'm afraid won't go easy is getting Branny and Queenie to cast off once Fern and me are back on the Arcadia. Has Silas told them that only me and Fern are left? That Camellia's gone? And Lark and Gabian are far away? Do they know? I can't think about it too hard because it hurts. Don't borrow trouble from round the bend, Branny always said. Right now, I just have to concentrate on getting down the slough to the big river. From there, we'll stay close to the shore and watch out for the wakes off the boats and the barges, and keep an eye on the drift piles and strainer trees and such. Many's the night here at the Sevier's house. I've climbed way up in the cupola and looked out. I can't see the river from there, but I can feel it. I'm sure I hear the foghorns and the whistles far off distant. At the edge of the sky, I can see the Memphis lights. From what Arnie's told me, I figure the slough that drains off this lake must hit the Old Man River someplace between the Chickasaw Bluffs and the bars upwater from Mud Island. Arnie's not exactly sure, but I can't be wrong by much. Arnie nods, and it's a relief. All right, I'll take you. But it's gotta be tonight. No way of knowing when my brothers will get back. Good. Fern and me will sneak down here as soon as the moon comes over the treetops. We'll meet you at the boat. You be sure your daddy gets into his whiskey early this evening. Let him eat real good, too. That'll make him sleepy. I'll check that Hootsie brings down plenty of food for supper. That won't be hard. All I have to do is tell our new mommy the boy here in the camp is hungry and didn't have enough to eat. She'll make Zuma rustle up extra. Mrs. Sevier has a heart that's soft as a dandelion puff. It's just as fragile, too. I don't want to think about how she'll get by once we're gone. I can't think about it. Queenie and Briny need us, too. And they're our folks. It's simple as that. There's no other way to look at it. It's time for us to go. Arnie nods again. All right, I'll be there at the boat. But if we were to trek down river together, there's something you ought to know first. Might be it'd change some things. What's that? My breath hiccups a little. Arnie's bone-thin shoulders lift and fall, and he cuts a narrow look at me before coming out with it. I ain't no boy. He unbuttons his shirt neck, which isn't much more than rags anyhow. There's a strip of dirty old sack muslin wrapped around under there, like a doctor's bandage. And Arnie ain't a boy. Arnie's for Arnell. But Daddy don't want nobody knowing it. People won't cotton to me working if they find out. Now I'm sure more than ever that Arnie needs to stay down the river with us. On top of the fact that he's a she, and this is no kind of life for a girl, there are bruises all over her skinny body. But what'll Zeed say about a girl on his boat? Maybe Branny and Queenie will let us keep Arnie on the Arcadia. Somehow, I'll make a way. It don't matter if you're a girl, Arnie. We'll find you a place. You just be ready tonight once the moon's over the trees. We pinky promise on it. And then Arnie's daddy hollers for her from the other side of the trees. Lunch is over. All afternoon, I wonder if Arnie will be at the boat tonight when Fern and me get there. But I figure she will, because when she thinks about it, she'll see there's not much to hold her here. She needs to get away down the river as much as we do. The Sevier's talk in their bedroom again before Mr. Sevier heads into Memphis for his meeting. When they come down, he's carrying a little overnight bag. If the meeting runs late, I may stay in the city, he says. And then he kisses Fern on the head, and me too, which he's never done before. I grit my teeth and try really hard to be still while he leans over me. All I can think about is Mr. Riggs. You three take care of each other. He looks at Mrs. Sevier. Don't worry. Everything will be fine. Zuma hands him his hat as he walks out the door. And then it's just us womenfolk. Mrs. Sevier tells Zuma and Hootsie they can go on out to the carriage house and kick their feet up. There's no need to fuss over a meal. We girls will just have ourselves a tray of finger sandwiches. Zuma fixes the tray real cute before she leaves.
A little pajama party just for us. Captain Midnight is on the radio tonight, Mrs. Sevier says. And hot cocoa, too. Maybe it'll settle my stomach.
She licks her lips and presses a hand over her tummy.
I don't think my stomach feels too good either.
I'm itching to get upstairs and gather some things together. I won't take any more than I have to of what the Sevier's bought for us. It's not right. Anyhow, we have things on the Arcadia. Not fancy things like these, but we've got what we need. What would a river gypsy want with ruffled dresses and shiny leather shoes? The clackety soles would scare all the fish away.
You girls go on and wash up and put your gowns on. May, you'll feel better once we're all settled in with some cocoa and treats.
Mrs. Sevier wipes her forehead with the back of her hand, then pushes her lips into a smile.
Come on now. We'll make a lovely evening of it. Just us girls.
I take Fern's hand and head upstairs. Fern's so excited about our party with Mrs. Sevier, she washes herself and gets her pajamas on lickety-split, even if her nightie is backward. I fix it and put her robe on over the top and get mine on too, but I keep my clothes underneath. If Mrs. Sevier notices, I'll just tell her I was chilly. Lately, it's been cool in the house at night. One more reminder that it's time to get back to the river before winter sets in. I try to act like I'm happy about our radio party, but I'm nervous as a cat while we're eating our finger sandwiches. I drop one on my robe and stain it, and Mrs. Sevier wipes the mess up for me. She checks my forehead for a temperature.
How are you feeling now that you've had a little something to eat?
All I can think is that I wish she was Queenie. I wish Queenie and Briny owned this big house. And I wish Mrs. Sevier could have babies one right after the other like Queenie does, so she wouldn't be lonesome after we're gone. I shake my head and whisper,
I might ought to just go on up to bed. I can take Fern with me and get her settled.
No need for you to bother. She runs a hand along my hair, gathering it in her fingers and lifting it off my neck the way Queenie used to. I'll bring her up when she's ready. I'm her mommy, after all. Everything in me goes cold and hard again. I barely even feel it when she kisses me on the cheek and asks if I need her to come tuck me in.
No. Mommy.
I hurry out of the room quick as I can, and I don't look back even once. Upstairs, it seems like forever before Mrs. Sevier brings Fern to bed. Through the wall, I hear her sing a lullaby. I push my hands tight over my ears. Queenie and me sang that song to the babies a lot.
Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses.
All of it tangles in my head. The Arcadia and this place. My real parents, and Mrs. Sevier, and Mr. Sevier, Queenie, and Mommy, and Briny, and Papa, the big river, the Oxbow Lake, the slough, long white porches, and little ones that drift and drift and drift over the water, not painted at all. I play like I'm asleep when Mrs. Sevier comes into my room and feels my forehead again. I'm afraid she'll try to wake me up and ask how I am, but then she leaves. The door closes at the end of the hall, and I can finally breathe easy. The moon's just coming up when I put on my coat and shoes, strap a little poke onto my back, and slip into Fern's room, and lift her out of bed.
Shh, be real quiet. We're gonna walk to the river and see if we can spot some fireflies. If anybody hears us, they won't let us go.
I wrap my little sister in a blanket, and she's asleep on my shoulder before we're down the stairs and out the door to the porch. It's dark and shadowy there, and I hear something scratching in the gardens near the house. A coon or a skunk, maybe. Mr. Sevier's hunting dogs bark when I step off into the grass. but they quiet after they see it's just me. Nobody lights a lamp in the carriage house. Dew flicks up and sprinkles my legs as I hold Fern tight and hurry toward the trees. Over branches, the moon shines high and full, as bright as the lantern Briny always hangs on the Arcadia at night. There's plenty of light to see by, and that's all we need. We're down to the lakeshore quick. Arnie is waiting, just like she promised. We whisper, even though she tells me her daddy's dead dog out cold from whiskey like usual. If he wakes up and wants me, he ain't gonna get himself upright to come looking. But Arnie hurries us into the boat anyhow. Her eyes are wide white circles in her thin face when she checks over her shoulder toward the camp. At the last, she stands there with one hand on the little John boat and 2 feet on the shore. It seems like forever that she's turned toward the camp, just watching. Get in, I whisper. Fern's waking up a little in the bottom of the boat, yawning and stretching and blinking around. If she figures out what's going on, I'm afraid she might raise a fuss. Arnie's fingers drift off the boat until only the tips are touching. Arnie! Is she thinking of sending us on alone? I've got no idea how to run the motorboat by myself, and I don't know the way through the slough. We'll get lost in there and never come out. Arnie, we gotta go! Past the treetops, the shadows shift on the lawn, and I think I see streams of light moving over the grass. They're gone by the time I stand up for a better view. Maybe they were only in my mind. Or maybe Mr. Sevier decided to come home tonight instead of staying in the city. Could be he's parking his car and walking into the house right now. He'll look in our bedrooms and know we're gone. I wobble across the hole and grab Arnie's arm, and she jumps like she's forgot all about me. Her eyes grab onto mine through the moonlight. I don't know if I oughta, she says. I won't never see my people again. They treat you bad, Arnie. You have to leave. You have to come with us. We'll be your people now. Me and Fern and Briny and Queenie and old Zeed. We stare at each other for a long time. Finally, she nods and casts off the boat so fast, I fall over the top of Fern. We take the paddles and row out a ways, letting wind and the current pull us along toward the slough until we're well out from shore.
Where's a fireflies?
Fern mumbles when I crawl over her.
Shh. We gotta get all the way to the river first. You might ought to sleep a while yet.
I pull her blanket up tight and put her shoes on her bare feet to keep them warm and let her use the poke for a pillow.
I'll wake you up when it's time to look.
There won't be any fireflies. But when Fern finally sees the Arcadia, she won't care a bit. Arnie starts the motor and sits down in the stern to run it. I take my paddle and move to a place up front to watch for drift logs.
Light the lamp, Arnie says. There's matches in the box there.
I do what she asks, and just a few minutes later, we're slipping down the middle of the wide, clear lake, stirring the night critters as they skitter away from the circle of lantern glow. I feel free as the Canada geese that pass by overhead, honking their call notes and dotting out the stars. They're headed the same way we are, south to the river. I watch them pass and wish I could catch onto one and let it fly me home.
Best keep a lookout up there.
Arnie slows the boat when the lake narrows and the trees squeeze in closer.
Push off the drift if you spy any. Don't let us run up on it.
I know. The night air cools and thickens, and smells of the slough. I button my coat tighter. Trees shut out the sky, their bottoms wide and twisted and rooty. Their branches reach at us like fingers. Something scrapes along the hole and lifts us on one side.
Keep us off of them, Arnie barks. One splits the boat, we're goners.
I watch for logs and cypress knobs and any sort of driftwood, I push it away with the paddle, and the miles go by slow.